Case number 13-1231 et al. Spectrum 5 LLC, Appellant v. Federal Communications Commission. Mr. Engstrich for the appellant, Mr. Dunn for the appellate.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to try to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
The FCC unlawfully granted special temporary authorization to move the EchoStar 6 satellite. The FCC's reliance on the coordination agreement to justify that decision fails for 3 independent reasons. First, any concessions contained in that agreement are not among the circumstances requiring temporary operations, and that is what both the statute and the FCC's rule require to be extraordinary to justify bypassing the normal licensing procedure in favor of this special temporary authorization procedure. And as the Bureau found in paragraph 8, the only reason EchoStar bypassed the normal licensing procedure was because of the international deadline. And the Bureau has also long found that that is an insufficient reason to grant special temporary authorization. But there's a second problem with the reliance on the concessions in the agreement. You haven't seen it. I haven't seen it. It's 23 black rectangles covering the entirety of the page in the joint appendix. The FCC has offered no explanation or justification for its refusal to show you the coordination agreement, despite the fact that under the APA, Section 706, review is supposed to be on the whole record. We're not talking about public disclosure of the agreement. We never asked for that. We suggested filing it under seal. We even offered up seeing it on an attorney's eyes only basis, even though that's prejudicial to our ability as lay lawyers to understand it. Flatly refused. The third problem for the FCC's reliance on the coordination agreement, in the order itself in paragraph 9, the FCC claimed only that that agreement protected DirecTV's established operations. Yet DirecTV concedes at pages 9 and 12 of its amicus brief that if the FCC had not granted special temporary authorization, the BermudaSat 1 filing would have expired, and DirecTV's 3 satellites and satellite filings for the 101 location would have been fully protected.
Okay. Before we get into those three, could I ask you to take a step back and address standing?
Absolutely.
I got your argument about injury, but I'd like you to focus specifically on redressability for us. Proving standing, establishing standing in this court is your obligation. And what I'd like to hear is your best argument that you've satisfied this court's standards for redressability when the action is, when the third party that, you know, is required to act isn't before the court.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay, why don't you focus on that specifically?
I will.
Yeah.
As we explained, I think there are two ways we get across the significant increase requirement, that there's a significant increase in the prospect of obtaining a favorable decision before the Radio Regulations Board of the ITU on Netherlands' objection. The first is simply vacatur of the FCC's order. And vacatur is important in two ways, because as this court knows, vacatur renders the authorization a legal nullity. It is as if, for legal purposes, it never existed.
Right.
And there's two things that follow from that. In order for the United Kingdom to claim that it had brought into use that filing, it needed, one, a satellite to be there. And satellites can't move around willy-nilly. They need legal authorization. So we would have a satellite with no authorization to be at the 96.2 location.
Wait. I'm looking at 1144B, which is what this is all about. And it refers to it has to have, the satellite has to have capability of transmitting, correct?
That's correct.
And the question is, does capability mean, if I'm not right about identifying this issue, you just tell me, but the way I look at this case, it seems to me the question before us, does capability mean technical capability or legal authority to exercise that technical capability? That's the question, isn't it?
In our understanding, Your Honor, from the ITU circulars that we cited, It includes both.
And which, let's, but you agree that's the question. In fact, let me ask you the question this way. Suppose it were totally clear that capability simply meant technical capability. If the ITU didn't really care whether there was legal authority, that it just had to have technical capability for 90 days, would you then agree that there's no standing, no redressability?
No, Your Honor, because there's multiple prerequisites to the United Kingdom's claim. So one, we believe capability includes legal authorization, and we've cited ITU materials that suggest as much.
And two, let's just talk about what those are. Okay? Well, you're talking, one thing you cite is the circular, correct?
Yes.
Right? But the commission's response is that that ITU refers to the satellite network's license application, not to the decision of the FCC.
We think if the only thing that the international body cared about was technical capacity, then the license application would be irrelevant as well, because the license application doesn't govern.
A lot of technical, I assume they want to look at it because it's full of technical stuff, right?
I assume they want to look at it because they're trying to ensure that satellites are where they're supposed to be.
But why? Where are you looking? Because of the relevant page, I think, is the addendum to your brief at page 9, or is that not the right place? And on that, it says, with respect to the capability language that we're talking about.
That is it, Your Honor. 2.41, it's the next to last, the penultimate bullet.
2.4.1, right.
Yes.
The Bureau has developed a non-exhaustive list of possible types of information that might be requested to verify the transmitting and receiving capability of a satellite. And which makes it seem to me that it's talking about the technical capabilities, not the legal landscape underlying that.
Your Honor, I agree that's one possible reading of that, and we believe that given the need for for domestic authorization to move satellites as well as international, that it doesn't make sense to understand the ITU is not caring.
But you see, the reason we're asking these questions is I don't think we can decide this on the basis of whether it makes sense to us.
Well, that's why, Your Honor, if I can move to the second.
Your obligation is to establish standing, and that means there has to be a substantial likelihood that the relief, and just to follow up on Judge Srinivasan's question, at Addendum 64, there's this letter from the ITU, the information it's asking for is all technical, satellite location, capacity, power adaptation, steerability. There's no question about whether it has legal authority.
Well, Your Honor, at the time the ITU staffers write this letter, it had legal authority, right? This special temporary authorization had been granted.
Right, but later on, I thought the Netherlands specifically pointed out that this was an open issue in this proceeding, and then subsequently...
Exactly. Preceding this letter, the Netherlands pointed that out, but there was no need for the International Telecommunications Union to ask the United Kingdom about the status of an American judicial proceeding. We don't think the absence of a question about a case that hadn't been decided yet...
Would they have waited to act? I mean, it just seems that there's
nothing... Well, they haven't acted yet, Your Honor. This is teed up now to be set at the July 31st meeting of the Radio Regulations Board. I would hope that we will have this court's decision by that point, and that the International Radio Regulations Board can consider.
Did they make a determination that the satellite had been brought into use?
The staff made a preliminary decision. Challenged by the Netherlands. It has not yet been put on an agenda, but the Netherlands intends, I understand, to put it on the agenda for the July meeting. But if I can move, Your Honor, to the second...
Wait. No, I just want to ask you one more question. So tell me so we get your best argument. What's your best argument then that if you get our decision before July and you win, that there is a, quote, substantial likelihood that ITU will deny the UK?
There are three prerequisites, Your Honor, to the United Kingdom's claim that turn on the vagary. There are other prerequisites as well that are mentioned, some of which are mentioned in the Netherlands letter. Mm-hmm. We believe legal authorization is, but it's also clear that the United States had to consent to the United Kingdom's reliance on a U.S. flagged satellite to bring into use its filing. That consent is found in the order. Vacater would, we think, take away that consent and remove a second leg. We also think, given that the proper remedy, as this Court's cases make clear, is one that puts Spectrum 5 in the position it would have been in but for the unlawful action. And there's no dispute about what that position is. That's a world in which the BermudaSat-1 filing had expired because it wasn't timely brought into use. That the FCC should be ordered to take an affirmative action to help bring that about. And the one I'd focus on is removing ratification of the coordination agreement, the secret agreement, that was privately negotiated between the two incumbent DBS providers in America. Ratification is also clearly a prerequisite to the United Kingdom's claim. And I think at least, even if we're wrong about capability and it's technical solely and legal authority is irrelevant, we are absolutely right that both the consent to the use of a foreign flagged satellite, or in this case a U.S. flagged satellite, and a ratified coordination agreement are prerequisites to the bringing into use claim.
But how is the ratification of the coordination agreement a proper remedy when, you know, those are parties that aren't really before us, and to the extent that, I mean, those parties could reach a coordination agreement, you know, completely outside of FCC action, right?
No, Your Honor, that's actually not right. For a coordination agreement to form the basis of a bringing into use claim, it must not merely be negotiated by the operators. It has to be ratified by the respective administrations. And here, the ratification is from a low-level FCC staffer, the chief of a branch within a division within a bureau, at page 161 of the joint appendix. Without that ratification, the privately struck deal between EchoStar, negotiated between EchoStar and DirecTV and SES, is worthless to the United Kingdom. The FCC is before this court. This court can direct the FCC in order to create a proper remedy, as recognized in the AT&T case, in the Exxon case, the draw on calorie properties, the Supreme Court's decision, can order the FCC to remove its ratification.
So suppose we didn't do that. Suppose we don't take the extra step beyond vacator. All we do is vacate, or at least by hypothesis we vacate for purposes of your argument. But other, the extra forms of relief that you request aren't on properly on the table, let's suppose. Then where are you?
Then we still have the fact that it's clear that for one administration to use someone else's satellite, you need that first administration's consent. The consent appears and exclusively appears in the orders. Vacating the orders would take away that consent, and that's one of the three, we think, or at least a minimum two pillars of prerequisites for the United Kingdom's claim. That should increase substantially the likelihood of a favorable decision. It's not a guarantee, but it doesn't have to be a guarantee.
And that's contingent on the ITU's. So what you're saying is in that situation, the ITU then would respond to the vacator by suppressing the...
Yes, at its July meeting where the Netherlands will place it on the agenda.
But the ITU letter says that the consent basically has to, or that any objection has to occur within 90 days from the receipt of information. So how can you really undo that consent at this point?
I think we can, Your Honor, because the effect of a vacator is to render the consent a nullity, as though it had never happened. So there wouldn't have been any consent within the 90-day period. This is a relatively new regulation.
How do we know that the ITU is going to interpret it that way, as opposed to saying, well, 90 days came and went, we got consent, and so that's the end of it?
Your Honor, it's a sufficiently new ITU rule that I can't point you to any ITU precedent applying it.
And do you agree, by the way, that I think this seems like an important point, do you agree that the rule that's being invoked, I think, speaks in terms of not objecting, and it's the same issue as consent? So the 90-day term does apply.
I believe the 90-day term is part of the rule that both the United Kingdom and the United States pointed to when they agreed to put this language in the orders. But we do think that the proper remedy is, again, under this court's. And I know the FCC doesn't address that, doesn't respond to that, doesn't. The only FCC claim is not that this court lacks authority to put us back in the position we would have been in. Their claim is solely that doing so would cause them to breach an agreement they made with the United Kingdom. Their claim is not one that the court lacks power, and the court clearly has power. I point the court to the Freeman Engineering and the Qualcomm cases, where the FCC, through its actions, deprived Qualcomm of a license. This court remanded in Freeman Engineering, ordering the FCC to grant Qualcomm a license. When the FCC failed to do that, Qualcomm came back, and because that license had disappeared, this court ordered the FCC to give Qualcomm alternative equivalent spectrum. So it's certainly within this court's power to order the FCC to take actions that would return us to the position that we would have been in but for the unlawful actions. And that's what this court in the AT&T case described as the proper remedy with no response from the FCC. I see I'm down to a minute. I'd like to reserve time, but obviously it's far as questions.
All right. We'll hear from the commission.
Thank you.
Good morning. Matthew Dunn, excuse me, for the FCC. So I'd like to start with redressability, where we pretty much left off with Mr. Engstrich. There are a couple points I'd like to make. This is, as the questions so far have indicated, at root an ITU dispute. It's a dispute over rights under ITU law. Only the ITU can decide that. There's been no showing by Spectrum 5, as is their constitutional obligation for standing, that vacator here would have any effect at all.
What about his argument that vacating would eviscerate or vacate the U.S. consent?
Yeah, that's an interesting argument, but I'm not sure exactly what it's grounded in.
Well, that's why I asked you the question.
Well, all right. I take his Your Honor, I don't believe that there's any evidence of that, and I think the opposite is the case. The FCC, on behalf of the United States, has agreed with the U.K. not to object.
Is that a different document? Is there a letter or something?
There's not a different document than it's in the coordination agreements, which are separate than the STA. Uh-huh. And it appears in the unredacted portion of the coordination agreements. There's also evidence of that in the order from the commission at the Bureau level order. So the FCC has agreed on behalf of the United States not to object.
And where is that agreement in the record?
It's
not in the order, something other than the order that we've been asked to vacate.
Right, so the coordination agreement, which is the agreement between the two administrations and operators, so that's at...
And so vacating the order wouldn't have any impact on the coordination agreement?
No, I don't think so. No, I agree, Your Honor.
But I thought his point was that the coordination agreement, everything was done with an eye towards reflecting the lack of, or the existence of consent in the order, not in the agreement.
I'm sorry.
The whole point of this enterprise was so that reflected in the commission's order.
So that the SDA could be issued in the EchoStar. That's correct, but I guess there are two problems with that. One is even if there's that was sort of a factual predicate for the United States agreeing not to object, that it still made that agreement on behalf, FCC still made that agreement on behalf of the United States or the UK. So even if that factual predicate disappeared, it would still be reneging on that separate agreement. The second point is, I think there's kind of a presumption of retroactivity here in the discussion about vacator, and as I believe maybe the questions from Judge Wilkins indicated, there's no reason to believe that the ITU would see a retroactive withdrawal of non-consent or a retroactive objection to have an effect on whether or not this was validly brought into use at the time when those 90 days passed. So there are sort of two separate problems. One is the non-objection is separate from the STA, and secondly, whatever the case, it's already occurred, so the ITU may well take the position that it's too late to go back and object now.
Well, suppose that the ITU assumed, or suppose that we even granted the relief that was requested by Spectrum 5 to the effect that the consent is annulled.
So
if that were true, then do you take the position that even in that event, the ITU still wouldn't do anything?
So the hypothetical is you grant relief ordering the FCC to retroactively object to the UK bringing into use. Of course, they have to show a substantial likelihood of success.
Right.
There's no showing that the ITU would apply that retroactively. You could imagine there'd be serious policy problems if a country at whatever time hence could retroactively object to another country bringing into use.
And does that map onto the questions about the 90 days? Are you relying on that at all? There's a 90, as I understand the rule, there's a 90-day window within which they...
Right. It's conceivable that had this the court ordered us within that 90 days to object, then that would have had effect. Is that responsive to your question?
Yeah. And so I take it your retroactivity point dovetails with the 90-day provision.
Precisely. So that window has passed, essentially.
That window has passed. And so at this point, it may be... I mean, we don't know because we don't exactly have a strong window into what the ITU's protocols are in this.
That's exactly, and that's of course the problem here is that this court is. I think the quote that we've given you is loath to find standing when another governmental entity has the discretion to decide one way or the other. We're not ITU lawyers here, so we're not sure exactly what the outcome will be. But it's their burden, of course, to show they could get relief.
Now, on the question of whether it's within our purview to order the agency to withdraw the consent or to voice an objection. I'm just treating those as equivalent for now.
Sure.
The opposing counsel cites the Qualcomm case. Do you have a response on why that would or wouldn't map onto the type of relief that they're requesting here?
No, Your Honor, and I was just searching through the brief looking for whether they had cited that before. Since it came at the end of the argument, I didn't have
time. Was it not? Okay. That may be it.
I could be wrong with that, but I didn't have a chance to verify that. I will say that there's an extra dimension here, of course, that a case like that, that the relief is entirely within the SEC's own discretion. It's a matter of domestic law. Here, what they're ordering is obviously that the United States should renege on an agreement with the UK, which, of course, adds another dimension to this relief. And, of course, they cite no precedent for that kind of extraordinary relief. Are there other questions on redressability?
Okay.
We didn't get to the merits from Mr. Antrick. I don't know if we will on rebuttal. I would just say briefly that this is the FCC here exercised its discretion, exercised its authority to interpret its own rules and find that this deal, which protected future operations from DirecTV, was a benefit to the United States, and so it constituted extraordinary circumstances under the rules.
But how can we determine that there was this benefit without reviewing the agreement that allegedly conferred the benefit?
Well, there's a lot of evidence in the record, Your Honor. It's in the order, and the order describes, and we cite that in our brief, and for example, paragraphs 13 and 9. There are also several other places in the record that make this clear. Bermuda said the same thing, and EchoStar said the same thing, and those citations are also in the record. And I think there's also some pretty compelling circumstantial evidence in that DirecTV, who's a competitor here, opposed the grant of this stay, then was able to reach this coordination agreement, and then dropped its opposition, and in fact appears as an amicus here. If the agreement provided no additional protections that they would have got in any case, then it's hard to imagine why they would do that. All right, if there are no further questions.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Engstrom, you had a minute left.
Thank you, Judge Tatel. I'd like to start on page 137 of the joint appendix. It's paragraph 2 of the letter that's otherwise entirely blacked out. What the FCC promised is that any authorization for operation of EchoStar satellite at 96.2 will state that the FCC will not object to the UK's reliance on a foreign satellite. It squarely ties the non-objection to the existence of an authorization to move the satellite. You take away the authorization, you take away the commitment the United States made. In the middle of the bit I skipped over, it also makes clear that its promise is contingent on ultimate ratification of the secret agreement. And there's no reason why the FCC, and those are two separate things. Agreeing to let the UK use a US satellite is one thing. Ratifying the secret agreement is a second thing. And there's nothing I heard from Mr. Dunn that says why the FCC can't be ordered to remove that ratification, especially when everything was contingent on that authorization happening. And I'd finally like to note that the secret agreement was cut between the two incumbent providers of DBS service. It keeps out a new entrant. Of course they're happy with it. It shouldn't be surprising at all. It doesn't suggest anything other than that the two big players got into a room and cut out the little guy. That's normally suspicious, not extraordinary. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both. Case is submitted.